Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today we will be joined by Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who will discuss her plans to reform the Republican Party.
Everybody has the right to have a discussion, have a disagreement, share their views, but I think we all have to be very careful about what's true.
A group home for people with severe mental illnesses has closed because of state budget cuts.
I don't know if I see things really getting a lot better, and I just hope they don't get a lot worse.
And Wyoming prepares to pay out as much as $180 million in rental assistance across the state.
So there's a need out there. We had no idea really how much need there would be.
Join us for those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. It's well documented that Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney was voted out as the third-ranking Republican in the U.S. House over her differences with President Trump. Today, she joins me to discuss this further, along with her prospects in the upcoming election. Representative Cheney, first off, thank you so much for taking time to visit with us. I don't know, has it been busy for you? Has it been an interesting couple of weeks?
Yeah, there've been a few things going on, Bob. That's certainly true. But it's always great to be with you guys, and thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
So let's talk a little bit about when you learned that they were probably going to vote you out of the position as the third highest ranking member of the Republican caucus. I was interested in your response. It seemed like you were ready to just kind of accept it and embrace it and move on. Is that a correct read?
Well, look, I think that it became very clear that, the requirements of staying in the position were things I wasn't willing to do. And, you know, that includes being silent about the danger that former President Trump poses, being silent about the big lie. And, I feel very strongly that as a party, we can't rebuild ourselves on a foundation of lies. And we have to make sure that people know the election wasn't stolen. We have to look at what did happen and why we lost so that we can get back the voters that we lost and move forward. But it became increasingly clear that, you know, my view about the danger and my unwillingness to be silent about it was inconsistent with staying in the position.
What has happened with your party? I mean, obviously, there have been a few lies over the last 4 years. Anything from fake news to maybe not even being exactly truthful about what's gone on in the pandemic from the president. And a lot of that has seemed to have been accepted. What has happened?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to separate out, the time period between, what happened before the election and what happened after the election. And I think that, if you're talking about it from a policy perspective, I voted with President Trump 93% of the time. His policies in a number of ways were really, really good for America, really good for Wyoming. The deregulation, the tax cuts, the commitment to investing in our military, all of those things were very important things that I supported. But what happened after the election, and certainly there were policy disputes before, but after the election, we had a period of time where the former president was completely within his rights to challenge, bring claims about fraud in court. And he did that. Over 60 different federal and state courts, heard the claims and rejected them. And that included some judges that he had appointed himself. And so as things evolved after the election and, we got to the point of the Electoral College meeting and voting, and John Barrasso, Mike Enzi and I, issued a statement saying this is over, Joe Biden's been elected president. It should have been over, but it wasn't. And so I think, you know, the continued lies about what happened, and then, of course, provoking the attack on January 6th, you know, those are things that disqualify somebody from being able to, you know, be the leader of our party. They certainly should disqualify somebody. And I think that's, you know, we can't sort of look the other way when something as dangerous as what happened.
When you voted for the impeachment, were you at all surprised by the backlash in Wyoming?
I knew, obviously, that it was a vote that I would have to spend a lot of time explaining and talking about, listening to people's concerns about it. But I also knew that I didn't have a choice. You know, people have elected me, and I've sworn an oath to the Constitution. And every 2 years, obviously, they get to decide whether, you know, they want me to continue to be their representative. You know, I think that there was no question about what that vote had to be. And I knew that it, you know, would be something I would be talking to my constituents about and hearing from them about, you know, as I explained my perspective on what had happened and why that was so necessary.
It would seem to me that if I was in your shoes after years of representing probably the Wyoming Republican Party in particular, the way you have, I'd personally be a little irritated if people started censuring me. What's been your reaction to all of that?
I think that people, if you look at some of the language in the censure resolutions, you know, it's just not, it talks about BLM and Antifa being responsible for the attack, which isn't the case. I think that, you know, everybody has the right to have a discussion, have a disagreement, share their views. But I think we all have to be very careful about what's true. And I think one of the problems we have, you know, across the state, but also across the country, is sort of the collapse of truth. And there's so much information out there that is just simply false. And so, you know, I wasn't surprised by the censures, I suppose. And you know, I look forward to continuing to talk to folks all across the state about my view and working to earn people's votes. And you know, I think that in this upcoming election, the issue is really very clearly going to be in Wyoming, a choice between you know, a candidate who has defended the Constitution, will continue to do so. You know, I take my oath very seriously, and he fights for Wyoming. And if, you know, former President Trump decides that he's going to endorse, then, you know, the choice will be, you know, a candidate who's pledged loyalty to an individual. And I think that's wrong, and that's not how our system's supposed to work. And I look forward to having that discussion and debate with the voters in Wyoming.
Liz Cheney visiting with us again today, our U.S. representative. Let me just ask you just a little bit about that. So you looked at polls, I'm sure, and I'm sure you've done your own, so maybe you have different things that you're seeing than others are. But, you know, this drop in popularity, how do you get that back?
Well, I really I believe that ultimately, you know, I trust the people of Wyoming. I trust the voters. And, you know, what I've done both with respect to impeachment and with respect to standing up for our democratic system, you know, in the face of attacks by former President Trump, those are principles on which I'll stand. And I'm very comfortable, you know, laying my record out for the voters. But also, you know, Wyoming is very much going to be ground zero in 2022 for this question about, you know, is the Republican Party going to move forward based on ideals and substance? Are we going to reject the big lie? Are we going to move forward in a way that embraces the Constitution? You know, or are we going to be complicit in what is really dangerous assault on the rule of law that we're seeing from former President Trump? And you know, I look forward to having that discussion and debate, you know, every single day. It's a very important one, and I have confidence where the people of Wyoming will come out on that.
Ian, as I asked you last week, there's obviously some issues with our own Republican Party, not only towards you, but maybe to a lot of even moderate Republicans in the state. It seems like it's a little bit of a battle of where this party needs to be. What's your sense of how you get around the party leadership and maybe get that rank and file Republican to come back, support you, and maybe change things in the party?
Well, look, I look forward to, you know, working with and talking to everybody. I think that one of the great things about Wyoming is voters make up their own minds. They make up their own minds, you know, usually based on having the chance to sit down and talk to the candidates, talk to the elected officials, hear from them, and also, you know, have them listen. And I think that these issues that we're talking about are ones that really do lend themselves to that. I mean, these are not sort of the, I suppose, the traditional political issues that you might be addressing in a congressional race. And you know, I think that it tells you something about where we are as a country, and how high the stakes are, and how important it is that we put some things above party, and some things above partisanship, and I think, you know, making sure people understand that and understand what a moment we're in terms of being able to make sure our party reflects principles and substance and a fidelity to the Constitution. I think that's going to be fundamental.
U.S. Representative Liz Cheney, a pleasure chatting with you, and thank you for making time.
It's always great to talk to you, Bob. Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we will turn our attention to the climate. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Carbon Valley, one entrepreneur wants to help the climate by using carbon dioxide to create a new fuel for planes.
We eventually get to the point where there's no more fossil fuels being extracted for aviation, and we lock up that billion tons into a circular fuel.
We explore how this vision for carbon capture squares with Wyoming's own. I'm Cooper McKim. Find Carbon Valley under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Last year, Colorado lawmakers pointed a finger at what they saw as a growing threat: speculative investments in water rights. Since then, a state work group has been examining the issue. The process has brought up some thorny questions about the entire system the Western U.S. uses to divvy up scarce water supplies. Reporters Heather Sackett from Aspen Journalism and Luke Runyon from KUNC have more.
Melting snow and flowing irrigation ditches means spring has finally arrived at the base of Grand Mesa in western Colorado.
We're along the banks of the Alfalfa Ditch with the team behind Conscience Bay, a Colorado-based investment firm.
So they can turn water back into the main stem of the creek here, or they can let it run on down this way.
That's company president Eli Feldman. The water from this ditch is spread across an arid valley to grow hay and pasture for grazing cattle.
This is Hart's Basin Ranch. The company owns it, and a contractor runs it.
And they own the rights to much of the water in this ditch, too. Conscience Bay bought the ranch in 2017, and its intentions have been under scrutiny ever since.
From local officials and other ranchers.
Anytime you come into a place that you're not from, people are curious at best and skeptical and concerned at worst.
Feldman's company has been accused of speculation, of buying this ranch just for its senior water rights and hoarding them for profit, an accusation he says is false.
Because just like every other major water user in the state, the water here is being put to use and not simply accruing value.
We're growing grass and feeding it to cows and trying to improve the ground, improve the soil health, and make a business out of it.
But investments like these are being scrutinized by a state-sanctioned work group made up of some of the most prominent water thinkers in Colorado.
State lawmakers have made the issue a top priority. They want to prevent out-of-state interests, motivated by increasingly dry conditions, from buying up water rights. Colorado State Engineer Kevin Ryan co-leads the group.
I think it's a valid concern because they do see unusual parties, large parties that, again, aren't the typical parties purchasing those water rights. So that's their concern.
Like many Western states, Colorado considers the right to use water as private property that can be bought and sold and moved from farms to fast-growing cities.
The state already has laws to make sure it's put to use right away. That means discussions about reining in speculation come down to intent.
Do we want to protect against certain types of intent? And then how do we determine that?
So is someone purchasing water rights to grow hay?
Or are they hatching a nefarious plot to act as the middleman and sell the rights off to the big city nearby?
There aren't speculation police roaming the state and breaking up these investments, right?
That's Alex Funk with the Colorado Water Conservation Board. He's also a member of the work group.
Funk says they've struggled to come up with answers to even some basic questions.
Like, what is the definition of speculation?
It's one thing to point at something and say, oh, that's probably speculative. Another to actually put the legal definition on it.
Farmers and ranchers see both a threat and opportunity in the rise of the private water investor. On the one hand, they worry about their communities if all their neighbors sell.
But when it's their turn to receive a check for their water rights, they don't want regulators to restrict who can purchase those rights, even a private investor. Carlisle Currier is a rancher in Molina, Colorado, and the president of the Colorado Farm Bureau.
Because if the government can tell them they can't buy a farm and farm it, well, they can tell me that, too. I don't want them telling me that, so.
Back at Hearts Basin Ranch, investor Eli Feldman says he's not the enemy. His operation isn't the mom-and-pop homestead ranch of the Old West.
It's the investor-owned, employee-operated, risk-taking ranch of the New West.
Is speculation just another word for investment? But it's got a negative connotation to it because it's somebody that's not from here? Okay, well, do you not want to have investment in rural Colorado? Is that what we're after?
He sees all the anxiety about speculation as a reflection of something much deeper.
Water supply throughout the West is shrinking, and deciding how best to deal with the growing shortages still comes with more questions than answers. I'm Luke Runyon.
And I'm Heather Sackett.
This story is part of ongoing water coverage of the West, produced by KUNC and Aspen Journalism, and supported by the Walton Family Foundation. Old Faithful Geyser is one of the most popular areas in Yellowstone National Park, but a major climate event nearly 800 years ago made the geyser a little less faithful. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel had a conversation recently with U.S. Geological Survey research geologist Shaul Hurwitz, who studied this strange period.
Based on a bunch of different reasons, we think that most of the big geysers in Yellowstone, including Old Faithful, are a few thousand years old. They're post-glacial. That means that after the glaciers receded from Yellowstone about 13 or 14,000 years ago, that's when geysers started forming. But exactly how long after that, we don't know. And some of them erupted and then stopped. So the same thing with Old Faithful. We don't know when it started, but we do know that the last few hundred years, it was erupting relatively constant.
What led you to look at the petrified trees around Old Faithful for evidence of previous eruptions or non-eruptions?
So I know that today, for example, there's no trees that grow on active geyser mounts. So when the geysers erupt, the water that splashes on the trees would not let them grow. So any of the geysers in the Yellowstone that you go around them, there are no trees. I read a paper that was published in the 1950s by a park naturalist describing a tree and some other trees. I didn't know how much, but he described the tree and the trees. So I knew that there was something special that when that tree was there, the geyser was probably not erupting just by standing from what we know now. So I was curious to know when that tree grew there to understand what were the conditions that led to that tree growing and what was with a geyser then that is different than it is today. So I applied with several colleagues to the National Park Service. And then when the park approved it, we went out there and sampled those wooden trees.
And what are some of the things you found?
We had a total of 41 samples that we used for radiocarbon dating. And we sent it in two batches, but the first batch we sent to the lab. And when we got the results, it was one of those too good to be true. All the results kind of clustered within about 100 years. I had to convince myself that that's a real result and not some random results. So I sent another batch, and those second batch also came exactly within the same about 100 year range, which is quite surprising. When you get radiocarbon dates, you have to do some corrections. And so we did the corrections. And after the corrections, everything came to be within about 100 years from about mid 13th to mid 14th century. So that was quite surprising. So I had to find out what were the conditions in the 13th, 14th centuries. So when I looked at climate, really, it ends up that that was just towards the end of a very dry period all over the Western U.S. It's called medieval climate anomaly. All the way to California, it was a very sustained, protracted period of droughts. Geysers need water. No water. If it's extreme, probably no eruptions. If it's less water, the eruptions can still go on, but be less frequent. So what happened then is probably was a very long period of sustained long droughts that caused the geyser not to erupt. And therefore, that allowed the trees, which are lodgepole pines, which are very adaptable to occupy the mound for that duration. And then when climate conditions changed again, became a bit more wet, the geyser started erupting and the trees died and no more trees grew since.
Do seasonal droughts affect the geyser's eruption or just mega droughts?
At the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st, there were a few years with relatively dry. And when that happened, we could see that the average of the annual interval of Old Faithful slightly lengthened when there was less precipitation. So we did see that correlation that, again, what happened, the geyser didn't stop, but average over 1 year, the eruptions were a few minutes longer, the intervals between eruptions.
How does your research relate to current climate predictions?
My research and this paper is trying to say, okay, in response to any climate, regardless of what the cause is, this is what Old Faithful might do. We rely in our paper on other studies that try to use models to predict the regional climate. And we say if their models would hold, this would might happen to Old Faithful. But again, if it doesn't hold, this would not happen to Old Faithful. So, but two of my co-authors in this paper are also from the U.S. Geological Survey, and they are climatologists. They reproduced the 13th century climate based on records that we have. We did not do any reconstruction or extension into the future. That is something that I know it's sensitive, so we just use other models and say if these models will hold, this is what will happen. Because again, the focus of this research was the finding of those trees and understanding why the geyser was erupting and not necessarily on the climate itself, which there's a lot of different paper that shows the effect of that medieval climate anomaly drought that I mentioned.
What does this mean for the future of Old Faithful and Yellowstone in general?
Yellowstone overall draws about, last few years, about 4 million visitors a year. And the Park Service has to plan the infrastructure to host these 4 million that would allow, for example, an amount of people to watch the geyser every eruption. If, as predicted, into the mid-21st century, conditions would be drier and drier, not only would we have more fires in Yellowstone, but it might be that the eruptions of Old Faithful would, for example, lengthen. The intervals would lengthen, not the eruption. The intervals between eruptions, that means that you would have at any given point more people waiting to see the eruptions in the Old Faithful area. So the Park Service would have to adapt the infrastructure to accommodate that change, for example. That's just one implication. If it goes for a sustained period of a lot of dryness, then maybe we'll get, you know, much longer intervals. Or if it was like that sustained drought in the 13th century, we might get even cessation if it's really extreme and sustained for a long time.
Shaul Hurwitz is a research geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey who studied Old Faithful's eruption history. Thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, a group home for people with severe mental illness is closed because of state budget cuts, and the state prepares to pay out millions in rental assistance. This is Open Spaces.
The This time on Human Nature, Greg and his best friend Rob dreamed of a huge Alaskan backcountry adventure together, but a wild river got in the way.
So my mantra when I'm on the trail is keep walking, don't die.
Reaching Rob's Roadhouse. I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. During this year's Wyoming legislative session, lawmakers cut $430 million from the state's budget. That includes a $7.5 million cut from the Wyoming Department of Health funds that go to communities across the state for mental health and substance abuse services. In Gillette, those cuts have already led to the closure of a group home for residents with severe mental illness. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler has more.
The Greenhouse Group Home in Gillette isn't well known. A lot of people in the community don't even know it exists. From the outside, you wouldn't know it houses up to six people with severe mental illnesses, and workers there give help and care to those residents so they can become fully independent.
We teach them how to plan meals, how to plan shopping lists, how to go shopping and find stuff, how to do their laundry, and probably one of the biggest things we teach them over time is socialness, because these people lack social skills, the majority of them, when they come in.
That's Karen Archer. She used to be the Greenhouse's assistant manager before it was forced to close. The Greenhouse was funded through the Wyoming Department of Health. Campbell County Health received the grant and contracted with the local nonprofit, the Council of Community Services, to run the facility. Michael Scott is the council's executive director. She says originally they thought they could absorb a 20% cut or so, but it turned out to be much steeper than expected.
No matter what we cut or what we did, there was no way to meet that number.
The department offered a reduced grant, but Scott says they ultimately decided the Greenhouse's $400,000 budget couldn't take the hit.
We can't reduce anything. You know, cutting the beds doesn't cut our cost at all. We still have to have just as many staff. We still have to pay for the facility, maintenance, everything else.
Karen Archer, the Greenhouse's assistant manager, says it was expensive to run because of the wraparound care the facility provided. In addition to helping residents learn about living independently, staff are making sure residents get to doctor's appointments, taking medication, teaching them how to apply for and keep jobs, and help them get housing for when their stay is over.
They've got problems, and you're just trying to help them navigate that, to seek solutions and to know that there are people they can ask for solutions.
Employees say they are devastated to see the Greenhouse close and worry what will happen to people who need this service. Housing Programs Manager Tracy Obert says it's especially heartbreaking when she's seen how good the Greenhouse can be for people who are often isolated in our communities. She has examples of people who have gone to college and moved out into the community and held successful jobs. Now Obert says those people who could have been helped may have to be treated at a place like the Wyoming Behavioral Institute, or they might have to bounce from community to community wherever they can find services or a place to stay.
Like, our homeless shelter has a 30-day policy. They'll use up those 30 days, they're going to go to Casper. They're going to use up their time in Casper, they're going to go to Cheyenne. They're going to go to Montana. They're going to go everywhere. And because they're shuffling around so much, they're not going to get the mental help that they need, the medication, and the physical help that they need.
Council Executive Director Michael Scott says she wonders about the downstream effects this could have on the community.
When folks are homeless, setting aside that it's just not good for people and it's inhumane, but they cost taxpayers in a community thousands of dollars more when they're on the street and they're having to use services like the ER and the jails and the homeless shelters over and over and over.
Lawmakers say budget cuts were necessary and know it's likely to have effects, but they are willing to wait to see how communities are impacted. That's what the Campbell County commissioners also decided. They considered chipping in funding to keep the Greenhouse open, but in an already tight budget year, they decided to hold off for now. But whatever happens, Scott says she hopes people don't forget about this issue in the long term.
You know, there's a little article in the paper and people feel upset about it for a short time, But I think it's a known fact that Wyoming, the grasp that we have on mental health issues is not the best. So I don't know if I see things really getting a lot better, and I just hope they don't get a lot worse.
There could be federal assistance coming to the state that could help programs like this one, but that remains to be seen. Meanwhile, lawmakers say it's time to reevaluate the state's mental health care system and how it can be more sustainable. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Gillette.
The Nationwide Emergency Rental Assistance Program is giving $25 billion to states, large cities, and tribes. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor reports that this program seeks to improve upon previous attempts at rental assistance.
Wyoming's cut of the Emergency Rental Assistance Program is about $180 million, with additional money for program administration. The Department of Family Services is responsible for distributing that money. Director Corin Schmidt says they've already received 2,000-plus applications, requesting more than $4 million in rental and utility assistance.
So there's a need out there. We had no idea really how much need there would be. High estimate was about 44,000 households would qualify, but of those, about 22,000 to 23,000 would probably be in a situation where they needed assistance.
And Wyoming's not alone. Andrew Arend is the Vice President for Research with the National Low Income Housing Coalition. He says nationwide, renters are struggling.
There's about 44 million renter households in the United States. About a quarter of them are extremely low-income renters.
Many of those low-income renters work in service industries like restaurants and tourism, which took a big hit during the pandemic. U.S. renters owe an estimated $60 billion in rent and utility arrears from the pandemic alone. Most states, including Wyoming, used some of their CARES funding to set up a rental assistance program. But when all was said and done, Wyoming's program gave out just less than $2 million. Arend says these earlier attempts failed in part because most places didn't know how to run such a program.
For many of them, this was new. They didn't have an emergency rental assistance program before the pandemic, so they were learning how to do it. They had to ramp up staff. They had to build up infrastructure to process applications. They had to decide how to implement the program. And so there was a learning curve.
The Low-Income Housing Coalition is now trying to ensure that states get the most they can out of this new program. The coalition even got revisions made to the U.S. Treasury's guidance for spending this new rental assistance money.
And one of the biggest areas was documentation.
Research conducted by the coalition and their university partners found that burdensome documentation requirements were a major hurdle for applicants in previous assistance programs. But the new guidance allows for self-attestations, documents an applicant can sign under penalty of perjury, saying they faced hardships during the pandemic. DFS Director Corin Schmidt says this will help Wyoming households who had to make tough decisions.
There are some significant costs, you know, such as medical care, child care, transportation, or expenses that you incurred because of COVID that were unexpected, that you wouldn't necessarily would say is had a direct effect on your rent, but it certainly affected your household budget, and that made rent more difficult to pay, or somebody chose not to pay their rent and instead paid their food bill, for example.
Another hurdle for renters, their landlords. Arden says previous programs didn't have a way to give money directly to tenants if landlords refused to participate.
And so you would have applicants applying. They would be eligible for the assistance, but the landlord could just say, no, I'm not going to take it. I'd rather get rid of this tenant. And the tenant couldn't do anything.
So the new guidance allows payments to go directly to tenants when landlords refuse to take part. DFS Director Schmidt says it's still the state's preference that landlords get on board.
However, we recognize that some landlords may not participate. And so after a certain number of attempts to reach the landlord, if we are not able to receive confirmation from the landlord, then there is the allowance to pay the renter directly. So that is an option.
All in all, administrators and housing activists are hoping this program does more good than previous attempts at rental assistance. There's enough money in the program to help poor and even not so poor renters in the coming months. But will it make a dent in the housing crisis and allow low-income people to afford housing? Laramie Interfaith Director Josh Watanabe, who works with this population all the time, says he's not so sure.
You know, that's the $180 million question. I don't know. It is a lot of money. Whether or not that will put a temporary fix to the housing crisis And the problems that people face is a different question entirely.
Interfaith serves Albany County, but other counties have received funding to help residents apply for the program. Community organizations, like Northern Arapaho Tribal Housing, can also help renters apply. Watanabe says Interfaith will help both renters and landlords apply for the assistance, getting as much of that money as they can to the people that need it. But when the program ends in September 2022, the housing problems faced by Wyoming's poor will likely persist. For Wyoming Public Radio, this is Jeff Victor.
Changing gears. When we talk about air quality, we are usually talking about the air outside, whether it's affected by wildfires, smog, or even factory emissions. But those conversations typically end at the front door. The COVID-19 pandemic has made many of us think about indoor air in a whole new way. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen explains.
At the daycare at the University of Wyoming, you see a lot of what you'd expect. Toys, books, cubbies for tiny shoes, and that's not all.
We've got air purifiers, we've got CO2 detectors.
That's Mark Bittner. He's in charge of this place. He says those machines were added to reduce the risk of catching COVID-19.
I just really needed to find a way to help mitigate. Okay, what can we do now that we know these things are airborne? We have kids that some of them are too young to wear masks, so what can we do to help protect the children, help protect the staff that are here a little bit better?
The daycare's HVAC system got a boost to recirculate air more frequently, and each classroom now has an air purifier. And then there's the CO2 device.
It's not measuring COVID in the air, it's just measuring CO2 levels.
Here's why that's useful. CO2 is what we breathe out. So if there's a lot of it in a room, the air isn't fresh. You're more likely to breathe in the same air someone else just breathed out. But if the CO2 detector shows numbers on the higher end, Bittner says it's still not as if an alarm goes off.
It's not a panic. It's just find ways to move the air a little bit better.
Like opening a window or turning on a fan. These kinds of mitigation efforts happened all over the country as people were thinking hard about indoor air, many for the very first time.
As a result, most of us in this field have been working nonstop.
That's Shelley Miller, a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Colorado Boulder.
To try to communicate, provide interviews, write articles, put stuff on Twitter, just like any way we can possibly get the word out.
Get the word out about indoor air quality. Miller says historically, people have paid way more attention to the air outside, but even that started not so long ago.
We only realized in the 1950s that air pollution could kill you because of the London outbreak.
She's talking about the Great Smog of 1952. It was 5 days of disastrous air pollution, thanks to unusually frigid and windless weather combined with pollution from burning coal.
The sky and the light were blotted out, and London coughed and crawled almost to a standstill in murky yellow gloom.
The Great Smog shut down the city and caused thousands of deaths, and it spurred the UK's Clean Air Act of 1956. People realized that if we want clean air, the government needs to regulate that. And just as importantly, Miller says it gave way to thinking about outdoor air as a public good, something that we all share. But she says we haven't come around to that kind of thinking for indoor air.
What's happened with indoor air is that it's become a private good. This is your home. This is your space. The government is not going to invade your space or your home or your office building.
But better air quality at home can keep you healthy in a number of ways, filtering allergens, dust, as well as pathogens that make you sick. It's possible the COVID-19 pandemic could trigger change the way the Great Smog did. It could be a paradigm shift for indoor air, In fact, 39 scientists are calling for just that in a report published in the journal Science earlier this month. Miller and her CU Boulder colleague and aerosol expert, Jose Luis Jimenez, are two of those researchers.
So our society has been very successful at removing pathogens from water or from food. And they are very, complex, sophisticated systems that work very, very well.
We've come to expect our drinking water to be clean and the food we buy at the grocery store to be safe. But Jimenez says we're not there yet with indoor air.
Something our society just hasn't done it.
Jimenez and others say it's time for that change. The group of researchers wants to see standards for indoor air quality that include airborne pathogens and that are enforced. But that doesn't have to be complicated or even expensive. It can be as simple as plugging in a $100 CO2 detector and, if need be, opening a window. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
When we come back, we'll wrap up the program as we speak with the author of a book on a treasure that had the attention of many. This is Open Spaces.
One thing we're proud of here at Wyoming Public Media is our podcasts. Whether you're looking for a good story from human nature,
I was convinced some of them are going to die,
or you want to hear our region in unexpected ways through the modern West.
When women teach women, we're saving relationships one cast at a time.
We've got a whole world waiting for you online. Explore under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Last summer, a modern-day treasure hunt came to an end when New Mexico art dealer Forrest Fenn's chest of jewels, gold, and pre-Columbian artifacts were found somewhere in Wyoming. Fenn hid the treasure in the Rocky Mountains in 2010 after he was told he was going to die from cancer. Journalist Dan Barbarisi broke the news of the identity of the finder of the chest while writing a book called Chasing the Thrill on the Treasure Hunt. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska asked Barbarisi why people were so dedicated to finding the treasure.
It can be very hard to turn back because you get that mania. It starts to grab you of, I feel like I'm really close. If I didn't go explore this thing before I have to fly back to the East Coast and not be able to come out here again, I wouldn't be able to forgive myself. And, that's certainly something I've talked to a lot of other hunters about. And it's something that I think was, certainly could have been in play with a lot of the fatalities in this case, where, you run into a lot of situations where you just want to go a little more, you just want to explore a little further. And that might not be the smartest idea. That feeling can take hold pretty quickly. And once you're out in the field, it does sometimes become a little hard to turn back.
Another aspect of it is just Forrest Fenn and like his whole history and why he decided to do this. And you've met Forrest Fenn, you've talked to him, and I wonder if you can kind of just describe him a little bit. And from your understanding, why did he do this?
So what he would tell you he did it, is because he wanted to give people something to dream about. He wanted to inspire people, especially after the 2008 financial crisis, and give, people who may have lost something to wish for and dream about and get them outside into the wilderness. But there's also, why did he do this for himself? There's a lot of questions. I think, this is a man who didn't, I think, like the idea that he would just pass on and be forgotten. His father had died not long before he originally came up with the treasure hunting plan, and his father had been a beloved school principal. And after that, though, nobody really remembered him. And I think that deeply impacted Forrest, and he didn't want the same fate to befall him in some ways. I remember talking to him about legacy, and he very, quickly excused that. He said, I don't care about legacy, but I don't think that was true. I think he did care about leaving something behind and being remembered in some ways and doing something that had a lasting impact. I think he liked the idea that people would still be looking for his chest long after he was gone. You know, and look, this is a guy who he mythologized his own past. In his book, you know, his original book, The Thrill of the Chase, it's stories about his childhood. And there are hints in those stories, but you've got to learn all about Forrest Fenn if you're going to really understand where his special spot was, where he hit his chest, which is the special spot where he, in theory, wanted to die, wanted to put a chest down next to himself and die. So, you know, to understand his treasure hunt, you have to understand the man himself. And so he was his treasure hunt in so many ways.
Right. There's this huge community that has come from Forrest Fenn's treasure hunt. There's just these searchers, these hunters. And besides just searching for the treasure hunt, you know, what was kind of important to these people? Why were they continually interested and invested in it?
Yeah, I think the community element of it was really something that did bind people to the hunt in many ways. Some of them were from the search area, but many were not. Many were from far outside. And, you know, it's like the search season was actually half the year, let's say, depending on where you were. You know, in Wyoming, it's shorter. In Montana, it's shorter. In New Mexico, it's longer. You can go out in March and April if you need to. But for a lot of the year, you're just, if you're into Forrest Fenn's treasure hunt, you're doing it on the internet. At times, there could be a lot of conflict within it. At times, there was a lot of unity. You know, they did some really great things and, you know, raised some money for hunters who got into dire straits, things like that. It was like a very interesting thing because it's a venture that was intended to get people outside. And yet so much of it actually took place from somebody's bedroom on the internet, you know? So, but that said, there were hunters who met up and then went on, you know, group hunts together, who went, you know, quote unquote, boots on the ground together.
Yeah. When you heard that the treasure was found, what was your kind of original thought?
Oh my God, what happened here? So, you know, at that point, it was just trying to capture the emotions that people were feeling in that time and what it made the hunters feel and do and say, and also just try to figure out what was even going on and what was going to happen next. And if we could figure out, you know, who the guy was who found it and where it was located and all that stuff, because Forrest Fenn was not actually releasing a lot of information about it. And so there were a lot of questions. There was honestly a lot of anger in the search community about that. There were a lot of conspiracy theories flying around, a lot of, you know, this is all a hoax, this has been a waste of time. And so I was trying to kind of navigate that and figure out what was true and what wasn't.
And what did you find out?
Well, right. So, you know, Fenn did release some information about, you know, he released some pictures of the chest. He released that it was located in Wyoming, but he still wouldn't tell the exact spot or who had found it. And so then in early September of 2020, he passed away. And that inspired the finder, the guy who found the treasure, 2 weeks later to post kind of a remembrance of Fenn on the website Medium. And so I put in my information, who I was, and why he should talk to me. He reached out pretty quickly and I realized, oh my God, this is the guy. And we started talking for months and months. And, you know, I was trying to convince him to let me tell his story. And after a couple months of doing that, finally, he essentially agreed to that. And that was that he was Jack Stoof, who's was a medical student, 32 years old at the time, out of Michigan, who was the one who found the treasure.
You got to talk to Jack. I mean, what was his reasoning? You know, why did he start hunting for the treasure? And maybe just, you know, what was his reaction when he actually found it?
So many people who search for this want to believe in something. You know, they want the distraction, sure, but it also brings you back. You know, I mean, Jack had gone through treasure hunting books and stories and movies and stuff when he was young, and he loved the concepts of those things. This brought him back to that and allowed him to kind of play in that sandbox. You know, a lot of people, this brings them back to that childhood feeling of wonder. And I think he had that absolutely. Jack searched for it for years. You know, he actually very quickly came upon the correct general location. He spent a long time in that generalized area trying to figure out where it was specifically. That took him a lot of time. But he eventually did figure it out. And it was actually a spot that he had actually been essentially walked over on previous hunts, but he hadn't known what to look for at the time. And the chest was pretty well hidden. He actually felt a feeling of relief. You know, he went back to his car and he cried because he just felt so relieved that he wouldn't spend the rest of his life absolutely sure that he knew where the treasure was and not be able to find it.
I just wonder how you think, you know, maybe his reaction to the chest being found. I know that there's was a lot of discussion of him not believing it was going to be found in his while he was still alive.
What I have been told is that there was a little bit of disappointment there, you know, from talking to Jack. I think he loved that he got to talk to Jack about it, that somebody who figured it out and understood what he was trying to do found the chest. At the same time, I've also been told that his friends who talked about this believed he was disappointed that the chase was over. It ended in his lifetime and that it wasn't going to, you know, tantalize people after he was gone. So I think both things can be true.
Yeah, maybe. For you personally, do you think that, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about how the reasoning of Forrest for doing this was, you know, get people outside, go adventure. Do you think that happened?
In that goal, I think he definitely succeeded. This hunt is not black and white. You know, it is not universal good nor universal bad. There is a lot of gray area with it. But, you know, Forrest Fenn certainly did do something very interesting. He certainly did do something that was unique and different and that gave a lot of people hope and something to explore and dream about. And, you know, in those elements, I think those are a lot of very good things.
That was Camila Kadalskis speaking with journalist Dan Barbarisi, who just published Chase of the Thrill, a book on the Forrest Fenn treasure hunt. It's available on Amazon. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. You can hear the entire show or individual segments on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org or get our podcast at all the usual places. Anna Rader is our digital editor. We also invite you to find our stories on Facebook and our various social media platforms. Also, consider supporting our Wyoming news effort with your pledge via our website. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.